Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Phoenix, Arizona, it's time for Phoenix Business Radio, spotlighting the city's best businesses and the people who lead them.
Welcome, everyone, to the Learnist Show, broadcasting live to you today from the Business Radio X studios in Tempe, Arizona. I'm your host, Deborah Hildebrand, and for the next hour or so, we will be talking about course creation and related topics with our special guests. I also wanted to take a moment to thank our sponsor, The Learnist, which is the place to go if you are a non-tech business owner who is either developing or looking to develop an online course. We have membership-based service and a do-it-for-you program available for individuals and organizations who need assistance in developing online courses. You can find out more by going to thelearnist.com. That's thelurnist.com. So I'm really excited today to have our guests, Julie Scales and Amy Bonnet, on with us. Thank you so much, both of you, for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for having me too. All right, Amy. So if you could please take a moment to introduce yourself to the listeners and share a little bit about yourself.
My name is Amy Bonnet. I work in Fortune 100 companies as a program manager, and I also do a lot of volunteering throughout the community.
Okay. And Julie, how about you? Could you introduce yourself to us?
Sure. My name is Julie Scales, and I'm an instructional designer. I have worked with Deborah at the University of Washington, working developing courses for various formats, mostly in the online world. I'm here representing my own opinions about instructional design and not as a representative of the University of Washington.
Right on. We had a lot of fun, huh, Julie?
Yes, we did. And sometimes we didn't, but it's still all good.
How many years did we spend developing that program?
I think we're still doing it.
I think we still are too.
Right.
Okay. Amy, so to start out, can you talk about your experience in the tech field when you first started out in the 1990s and how this directly led you to what you're doing now?
So I started out in advertising before the tech field. I went back to graduate school. I was the only woman in the entire program. Never even thought to think of looking for a diverse company. And then was very thrilled to get a job in a tech consulting company to find out I was a quota. There were two women. We both were underqualified. And we basically were a minority. And so that's kind of how I started my interest in diversity.
Okay. And so you do diversity training.
I do. I don't do it officially. I do it with the organizations, the nonprofit organizations locally.
Mm-hmm. Great. And so, Julie, what attracted you to the field of instructional design? So you used to be an instructor. How'd you get into instructional design?
So my background is in English language teaching, and I taught for a number of years in the university setting, some community college classes, some immigrant and refugee classes. And within that, I had done a lot of work with curriculum and planning of classes and planning of new classes. I think that's something that a lot of teachers do. And at some point, I became involved in a MOOC, a massive online course like Coursera or edX. And I started hearing about things that other teachers were doing. That was the first time I heard about that. And then I started doing some screencasting videos for my own classes. And eventually that turned into an opportunity to work within instructional design as a field. So it was kind of a roundabout way to get into the field, but I think it's something that a lot of teachers do as well. It's kind of a natural pathway.
Yeah, I agree. I did a lot of, or I still do a lot of instructional design teaching at the university level. And what's so weird is that I started the instructional design, most of it with edX as well. So I did a program there with another instructor at the University of Washington. We did a IT project management course.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah. Yeah. It was very interesting. And so what attracted you to instructional design?
what was interesting was to work with a lot of different content. You know, when you're doing English language teaching, you're focusing a lot on the words to say something or how you say something. But instructional design allows you to keep learning about a lot of different things. I've always loved working with technology also. And I think that a lot of instructional design is using a lot of different tools. Kind of my gateway drug is what I call it. It was the program Audacity. I don't know if you've heard of this one, but it's a freeware program for audio editing. Uh-huh. So that one was something that allowed me to give feedback, you know, 20 years ago to my students. We could record files and email them back and forth to each other. And from there, you know, it's one tool after another. So that's been fun to keep on learning in that way also.
Right. Free plug for Audacity.
Well, it's a freeware program too. So, right. Know, nobody.
And actually, I do use that. I do use Audacity just because it's so easy, not because it's free.
they kind of go hand in hand, right?
Right. I mean, it's just so much easier to use. All those other programs, it just takes so long to learn them. So, Amy, how about your experience as a volunteer that educated you about diversity? Tell us a bit about the organizations you volunteered for and how that got you interested.
So, I started out with my children who needed a little bit of help in school. That was minor modifications in their program, which is very difficult to do in the state of Arizona, which is where I live. And so, I started out working just to get my kids what they needed during the day. And once I got everybody settled, my youngest one now is a senior in high school, then I started volunteering in the organization. So I wound up, you know, once you become kind of somebody in the community that is willing to volunteer, everybody asks you to do things. So, so it sounds like a lot, but all of my volunteer efforts are related. So I'm very careful about keeping the same focus. So I volunteer at the Phoenix Children's Hospital. On the mm-hmm. Family Advisory Council. And I also am on the Scottsdale Parent Council, and I also volunteer with GLSEN. And so basically, it's just to provide an environment for children where they get the right services in school and medically where they need for all children.
And how does that relate to your diversity training?
So being part of these groups, you get enormous amount of opportunity to go for training. And they want you to be trained and they want you to be able to speak to people in the community. And so that has given me such a vast experience. When I talk to people, they say, oh, you must be an expert, which is not true. I just know more than the person next to me in the room.
10% more, right?
And so what I started finding is this diversity concept can be applied to work. And so now I apply to my day job as a program manager, where if people are having difficulties, it's usually they're different in some way, which boils down to a diversity factor, and you just need to make sure that they align. And so I do a lot of reading now, and I go to a lot of training, and I seek the trainings out now. And so that's really mm-hmm. where I want to move on with my platform, is just train other people in business and in the advocacy groups. But just to make sure, like, an idea in an advocacy group is sexy, but implementing it, not so much. So I'd like to take that next bridge where they have an idea and they actually implement it.
Mm-hmm. Great.
Amy and I had talked earlier too about kind of, in my world, the topic of accessibility comes up a lot as well. And we're maybe not talking about the same kinds of diversity, but there are always differently abled learners, right? Mm-hmm. So when you're designing training, you can do a lot of things to make it accessible to people who have low vision or have auditory impairments. And if you do those things from the beginning, it's a heck of a lot easier for everybody to access it. And having things like captions on your videos or PDFs that can be read by a screen reader are little things that you can do to make sure that everyone can access your training.
Right. And how do people who are just starting out in instructional design find that sort of standard and guideline for that, Julie?
I think that there's a lot of information available online. I know the University of Washington is one of the leaders in accessibility training. And if you look for the DOIT Center, DOIT, and Google the University of Washington, you'll see a ton of resources come up on that. You can look up the ADA guidelines as well. If you take just one or two things and start little and go from there, you're going to make training that's better.
Right. So diversity is relative, and all teams have some diversity, right, Amy?
Yes.
And so how important is it to address it, even in diverse organizations?
So, and also, when I say it's kind of relative diversity, diversity can vary with a large organization from team to team, from time to time, and from project to project, or even just from issue to issue. And so it is very important to understand diversity, because if you take a team of people who are from all around the world, and you start using local jargon or slang, a lot of those people won't get it. And some of the cultures on your team will not probe you and ask you what they mean. So people have been to a meeting and have no idea what you just assigned them to.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's key items that you need to signal people, like using, and everybody says I'm a very literal person, so it's easy for me. But I'm very literal, and I use basically terms that are standard terms that if you looked it up in a Webster dictionary, it would mean exactly that. So this way, it removes kind of the people tend to be attracted to people like themselves, which is normal. So mm-hmm. It makes you interact with people who are not like yourself, because you actually can have a better communication. So I always use the guiding principle, like when you're in a meeting, pretend like you're writing an email and it's very formal English, then everybody will understand it.
Very good tip. And how does that, so if I was, what does diversity training look like? So if I was to do it as part of my team training?
So it depends on how far into diversity you want to get to. So if you're new to diversity, what I definitely recommend is a very high level 15 minutes saying, we're going to start learning about diversity, maybe learning about what other cultures are, just what diversity actually means to your team. And then also learning about how to address others to level the communication playing field. And then you can get into things like unconscious bias. You can get into empathy versus sympathy. You can get into what the different groups feel and see, and then how to use examples in work of diverse people.
Right. What's funny is Amy's going through my course right now, and she's already pointed out a few things that I've got in there that need some improvement. And so, I mean, you're laughing.
I have a feeling I'm going to hear more about Amy's comments soon.
Julie does a lot of my, we work together. She's the instructional designer and I'm the instructor. But how would you weave that into a training like that?
Into a training? So the first thing that people want to see is they want to see people like themselves, because we have a natural bias to see people like ourselves. So is your training showing people like themselves, whatever nationality, however that looks, whatever the, you know, the pairs of people. So like if you use a GLSEN model, they have a lot of different types of parents and they have a lot of different types of children. And basically a focus on everyone is equal and everybody should be represented in that training. So depending on what your team is doing. So if you have a lot of people who maybe, you know, in the tech field, maybe English is not their first language, you go a little bit slower, you show people that obviously don't speak English as their first language, and you take into account all people on the team. That's where you start. Mm-hmm. And then you broaden it out, because I think every company that is very successful would like to see diverse hires.
Right.
That's one of the first things that my children do is when they're looking for a company, because they are my children, they go and look to see how many awards they have for diversity, right?
So, wow.
And young people don't want to work in a company that isn't going to accept them depending on what stage of life they are in.
Right.
Amy, about people looking like me when we're developing courses, I know that when I'm looking for pictures or visual things to use in a course, it's always a struggle to find free resources. Even for women, I feel like when I'm in a business environment, most of the pictures are men and most of the pictures are white men. So it is a struggle to find resources of more inclusive groupings of pictures. Especially ones that are Creative Commons or don't have other copyright restrictions on them.
I completely agree. And so Amy and I, we had this conversation about how the diversity training can help you be a better course creator. right?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And so do you want to comment on that, Julie?
Yeah, I think that, well, a lot of the things that you have said have been things that I've been thinking about too. And really it impacted in terms of the things that I pick when we display them in the courses. We talk about the audio for people with visual impairments, but really, like you said, Amy, for people who speak English as a second language, then maybe they just want to turn on the captions too. You could even think about that as somebody who is doing the course in their spare time, right? And they're sitting on the bus and they're commuting and they want to be able to hear the audio instead of just see the audio, or they want to be able to download it and read it when they're offline because they don't have a great internet connection. We talk a lot about the user personas, right? Mm-hmm. When you're developing a course, and if you do a good job of researching from a marketing point of view, and then also from looking at who will sign up for your course, and not just having one user persona, but having several learner personas, then you're going to do a better job of taking those needs into account when you're designing the course.
Right. And that just expands your audience, right?
There's another aspect to this, what I call abilities. So some abilities are physical restrictions, some are mental. So mm-hmm. you might have someone with ADHD or anxiety. And mm-hmm. this is a very unusual thing to think about, but I've found with people that have those issues that having the screen captions actually relaxes them because they can see it. And so somebody with ADHD, their mind is like a radio station. Their mind just has more radio stations playing. So by displaying the text on the bottom gives them one less radio station to pay attention to, and it actually focuses them. So it's a way of focusing them. So really all of those, like there, I call it the wide hammer for a small, you know, for lots of things that could happen. And so having the text at the bottom is a big advantage to anyone. And it also keeps them organized being online. So think about someone, I'm not particularly paper organized, mm-hmm. but if someone like your class that I'm taking, Deborah's class, <Sort of. laughs> is very organized and there's no stress that I have to worry, where am I? Where did I put my notebook? You know, where's my textbook? And so it becomes a lot easier. Online teaching is much more accessible to everyone.
That's really interesting. I also prefer to put the captions on as well. But I haven't been tested for any kind of ADHD. But one other thing that I was going to say is, have you ever taken a LinkedIn course as well? I thought that platform was interesting because they allow you to take notes in the video window within the player. So you have the video, you have the notes, you have the handouts, and then you also have the notes that you take, and then it saves those and it gives you the reference to where those go. I don't know if that ever happens to you. I'm taking notes online, and then to tie those back to the video is sometimes a hard thing to do. So that was another thing that I appreciated from that platform from a design point of view.
So how does that work? Well, once you take the notes, where do they go?
They're saved in the window, and you can just access. There are several tabs on the right-hand side. One has the transcript, one has the artifacts that you can, that's not the right word, but it's the
assets.
The assets that you can use in the course, the files is what right. I guess they call it. And then just one other tab is the notes. So you can access that and it'll tell you which video it was that you were looking at when you were doing it.
That's cool.
I like that feature.
That is a great feature. I'll have to
the other thing that Amy said that I really liked was the ability to just keep your place. You know where you are. So the course remembers, oh, this is where you last were. Let's keep on going here.
Uh-huh. Perfect. That just kind of leads us into the next question, Julie. What are some trends that you're seeing in instructional design?
I guess it depends on what you're talking about.
So let's say technology.
So I guess in terms of technology, the thing that I see about technology is that it's always changing. There are some programs that are used a lot in the corporate environment, and those ones have been pretty stable, like Captivate or Articulate or Camtasia, with Captivate and Articulate being by far the most common in the corporate world. So mm-hmm. I guess you would just have to keep on learning. The other kind of buzzword that I keep hearing have been hearing for a couple of years is talking about design thinking within instructional design. And I think that really ties in a lot of ways to agile project management and thinking about those user personas or learner personas, as we might say, within the field of instructional design.
What do you mean by design thinking, just for those in our audience who are not familiar?
So I have to say, I am not an expert in design thinking myself, but from what I understand, it's basically starting with the learner with empathy and trying to connect with the learners and then doing iterations and rapid prototyping so that you have very quick cycles in your design. And you know, if you're thinking about developing video or something like that, you know, that iteration would be a natural part of the creative process.
Okay, so it's like an agile process, basically.
That's the way I understand it.
Okay.
And like I said, you know, you can, if you want to learn more about these things, there are a lot of online resources. A couple that I've used a lot for learning more are like the e-learning industry websites or Tom Kuhlman's e-learning heroes blog.
Right. What about other trends? I remember we were talking about the timing or the length of videos,
yeah, sure.
and courses.
There seems to be, and it's something that makes sense, to have short learning snippets. You know, we were talking earlier about LinkedIn Learning, and they say, hey, this is something you can do on your lunch break. So we're making sure that the learning is short and digestible, and we can fit it into different places in our lives. So from a design point of view, we have to make sure that, you know, all of those little pieces are really focused, and we know what the objective is and we know what the learner needs to get out of them.
Right. So when we did the videos, they were what? No more than 8 minutes?
Right. And now maybe 8 minutes is even, could be a long video, right? I think that the trend is to do even shorter.
Ah.
One thing that was interesting to me too, sometimes speakers talk at different rates, and I've noticed comments like, oh, I wish that person would hurry up, or I wish that person would slow down. And so another thing that you can actually do is have the video player be able to adjust the speed of the audio. And, you know, you might sound kind of like Mickey Mouse or something like that if you go too fast. But for somebody who wants to process the information a little bit faster, and you can still have the captions going along, then you can have those two things in tandem and you can make the video shorter and fit your time if that's what works for you, or make it slower if you need a little bit more time to process that same thing.
Right. I think that everybody was slowing my videos down. I wasn't.
That is true. No, Amy wasn't.
Amy didn't. Thank you, Amy.
Were you speeding other people up?
Well, I was just being down in that studio with Ryan and just trying to get as many videos in as possible. I think some of them I went a little fast. But, you know, you mentioned a little bit about agile. So I wanted to talk, since Amy's going to be going into teaching project management.
Oh, great.
Yeah. So Julie and I have built a lot of project management courses. So I want to discuss your journey to develop training material for project management teams.
So right now, I would say... lots of teams in the advocacy organization just need a little bit of process.
Uh-huh.
And I try to focus on whether it's agile, scrum, or waterfall, sticking away from terms that kind of unsettle people that are in the advocacy organization that have never heard these crazy terms before.
Uh-huh.
And just get them to, what do you want to do? What's the shortest distance between two points? And then how are you going to get there? And do you have the staff and resources to accomplish all that? And do you have your implementation plans ready? And maybe you do less because let's say if you take, let's say a law comes into effect of affecting education and there's no budget to change the curriculum, that law is essentially effective, but not very effective.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so what I'm trying to do is make people realize that there's a part of advocacy to of implementation. So it's not always having the big wins, but it's also making sure that people actually follow through with the big wins.
Right. And so what does the training look like? Is it different for every organization or?
It probably will be. I'm speaking to a school district now. So, and this school district is very diversity open. So it would just be to kind of level the education of what diversity is at first and then understanding how the teams would perform. So the first thing you have to do, and they teach you this when you study for your project management certification, is the teams need to be a team. Mm-hmm. So if they're still storming, you know, where they're not on the same page, we don't have a team yet. So what I would do is make sure we have a team and then move on from there and then see what the time availability is and how much they want to dive into it. Because a lot of times, you know, the process isn't something they have time for, but having something like a Trello website and saying, I have a project manager, that is not the way to do it.
No.
There's a little bit more to it. And so just getting them little tiny steps to having a process and framing out what they want to do as an organization and building their projects and building their teams and making sure that they actually have people that would like to be part of the implementation team.
Right. I've done some training in corporate and some public organizations, and the training, I have my base training, but it changes for every organization because you can't, it's not a one size fits all. Yeah. Especially with project management. Julie knows that, right?
Yeah. I was chuckling when you were talking about that. You just need a Trello website and you're good to go. Okay. As I think everybody that I've talked to has used about 5 different types of software to kind of track their deliverables. And it's super hard. Like you said, there's a lot of steps in the process that need to happen first before something like that can be effective.
Right. So speaking of project management, Julie, you had to become a project manager as an instructional designer. Do you see that as a normal thing? And what kind of things did you have to take on to do that?
Yeah, I think that every learning organization has the project management piece to it. And an instructional designer might be a de facto project manager. And you might have somebody else in that role as well, who is your project manager. And maybe that project manager is part of your learning team, or maybe they are outside in the business part. Whether or not it's your title, you do have to do a lot of these things. I think that we have used a lot of traditional project management approaches to try to do instructional design. And one of the challenges that I see is that it's super hard to define all of the work. So if you're doing the traditional work breakdown structure, you can't know what the work is from the very beginning. So it seems that an agile approach is a better way to do that, because you do your big picture planning and you define your goals for the project and the overall timeline. But then you allow some flexibility and some change for how the learning will actually take place within the individual sections of a course, whatever that course may be. Deborah was actually one who recommended me a book called Agile for Instructional Designers. Did you get this book too, Deborah?
No, I just said that you should have written it.
I should have written it. No, well, the person who wrote it comes from a corporate environment and she's done a lot of training, but she has something that's called LLAMA, which is a lot like Agile development. What does LLAMA stand for? It talks about a lot of these things, how you really need to be flexible and that change is not necessarily scope creep, right?
Right.
But really what you want to do is have the learning and meet your objectives. And that's something that's not necessarily accounted for. It's harder to account for within a traditional project management environment.
No, and I agree, because a course is basically a product, right? You're developing a product And mm-hmm. the best way to do that, to develop a product, is with the agile system methodologies. Yeah, I mean, I remember when we did the edX program. So it was a series of three courses. We planned out every course, all three courses. And then by the time we got through the second half, or that the half of the second one, we were changing everything. So all that work we put up front was, you know, yep. wasted.
Yeah, well, hopefully it isn't wasted at all. You still have to define the goal and the objective of a course, right? But the way to get there is something that may change.
Yeah, but I mean, we did those design worksheets, and I don't know if you've seen those. We did the design worksheets, like, down to each video that we were going to do for each course.
Right. And it's hard to do.
Because things change.
There's a, in the Scrum methodology, and anyone can Google that, it's SCRUM. Mm-hmm. There are guidelines as how far into the planning stage you should be. So typically you plan out 1 to 2 iterations, and you can define iterations from 1 week to a month. Mm-hmm. And so that's what they say is put it all, they call it a backlog, and they say put it in the backlog and don't do that. Now, always have a product roadmap where you have your vision, and everybody knows if I go around to the team, they all can say what the vision is, what the product will look like. But that level of detail that Deborah's mentioning, had she known, like, that probably was before Scrum. And so you, if you use the guidance, you probably would have maybe 2 weeks of detailed stories, mm-hmm. features that you would like to plan. And right. then you can reduce the work. But it's hard to tell how far out a team needs to go.
Yeah. And I mean, I would say that if I was to do this for a course, you know, going to have the backlog and then do so if I was going to do like a 2 week development, I could have, you know, the iteration backlog with all the videos I was going to do for that module or whatever I was, you know, and then move on from there and then get more detailed as I go along, because it does yeah. change. I mean, even now, the course I'm developing with you now that you're in, I'm changing it. I changed something this week, right?
Yep.
So I move stuff around. So that's how I do it. That's how I roll. So Amy, your next steps with the training material.
So my next steps now are, I have researched a lot. I have a lot of training. I started interviewing executives in the field, just mm-hmm. about very open-ended questions. What is diversity? Because each organization has a very different view right now. Lots of organizations are very diverse, but it depends on where you are. Like ASU has a very different diversity than a healthcare company. Mm-hmm. So right now I developed kind of some slides, and I am not an instructional designer by any stretch of the imagination. I have trouble drawing stick people. So. And my next steps are, I'm going to meet with Deborah, trying to see if we were talking about this before the show, whether diversity should be in the course, not a separate topic. Mm-hmm. Therefore, it's a little less awkward. Therefore, it's more mainstream. It should never be seen as something you do after the fact.
What do you mean after the fact?
So, like, if you add a module at the end for an hour on diversity, then it's kind of like, okay. Well, now I got to go back through and add diversity. But if you train diversity throughout the course, and that's kind of like what we were tossing up, and I don't really know where it's going to go. I'm very open-minded to it at the moment. But I'm beginning to hear from just the advocacy community, we don't want to be separate. We want to be mainstream. And sure, that's a way to put them back into mainstream. All diversity should just be a thing, and it should be part of training.
So one of the things that I've been thinking about in terms of instructional design versus project management, or how they relate to each other, is the idea that training is often related to performance, right? And when you're talking about diversity, it's hard to say exactly what the performance is. So what are your thoughts? Do you have any ideas about what kind of actions you would want the people who are taking the training to take? Sorry if I'm giving you a super hard question without really.
And this, I think it's important.
This is a very popular conversation. So the more diverse you are, the wider. So if you look at a volunteer organization, if I can engage people very quickly, I'm going to have lots of volunteers. No one will be turned away. Mm-hmm. And so the performance is basically teaching everybody about diverse practices that include everyone. So I would say the performance of a diverse team in a workplace would mean that people would start adopting more inclusive practices, using literal terms, going maybe a little slower if you have people who take longer to process, whether it be English as a second language or maybe it just takes them longer to process it. And that could really stem down to personality differences. And so the performance of it is your team's performance. Are you having less conflict from diversity? Now, conflict is always good in a team when managed correctly. So I'm not a proponent of removing all conflict, but just making sure your teams are diverse and they're getting along and they're able to perform. And
we
mentioned it before. It's empathy, understanding how different people feel. And you could see that by, in a software environment, the number of defects, the number of arguments, the number of miscommunications.
So you would it would just be like anything else. You would have to come up with metrics and measures, and then would you just survey them, or would be an observation, or
both?
Yeah.
Because some of the topics are very personal,
right?
And some of them you wouldn't be able to survey. So are you drawing a better diverse population to come and work for you? You can kind of tell easily. Sometimes it's visible. Sometimes it's not.
Right. Good question.
Yeah, sorry, I was still.
No, I think it's a great question because we need to measure what we're training, right? We have to make sure that what we're putting out there is getting taken in. They're taking it in, right? And they're actually learning. So, great question. So, Julie, what kind of advice would you give to someone who wants to transition into instructional design?
I would say, take my course. No, just kidding. I don't. I actually don't teach courses in instructional design.
You should. Maybe we'll do that, Julie.
I have a background in teaching. I think that teachers come with a lot of the skills that instructional design needs. But I did do a certificate in instructional design just to kind of think about teaching in a different kind of way. You know, we talk about curriculum and instruction within the teaching environment. A lot of times we are focusing on a K-12 population. So focusing an instructional design certificate typically talks about the adult learners and the needs of adult learners. And there's large focus on technology. So looking for some kind of certificate program or, you know, I'm a person who does well with deadlines. So if I pay somebody and I have a deadline when I need to finish the course, that was good for me. But there are a lot of resources available online as well. You know, you can go into LinkedIn and see their learning. I know that libraries often have those a subscription to that training as well. I would say just learn a program that you envision yourself using or like Captivate or Articulate. And you can do that with a course or you can do it by yourself. Find somebody else who knows how to use it and work together and get to know people, network. You could join professional groups. You know, as project managers, you have PMI there that I think that would be super useful. You can talk about ATD, the Association for Talent Development, and talk to people, you know, and have your schedule for your coffee meetings and follow up and ask people for advice on what they should do, on what they think you should do, you know. And one other thing that people always want to see is a portfolio of your work. So have a publicly available portfolio, whether or not you share it with everybody or you share it on demand. But that's something that somebody who wants to be an instructional designer should have and should develop.
When I think about an instructional designer, even though I do it, it just seems for somebody who was, you know, not in the field, it seems so technical, right? Like I have to know all this technology. Is that true?
Yes and no. I think that how much technology you need to use depends on the role. So earlier we were talking a lot about the goals and objectives and measuring measuring the learning. Mm-hmm. So that's definitely part of the job of an instructional designer. You'll often see jobs for e-learning developers or instructional technologists within the academic field. And I think if you see a title like that, for sure, then the technology is the most important person. But you are often working within a team. So how much you are the end user, the creator of something within some kind of software, it will really vary. For me, what has always been the case is that whatever technology I'm using, it will change. So probably the most important thing is to be able to keep on learning, right? Right.
Learning about learning.
Learning about learning, learning how to use things, learning. I don't know. There's always this blog and a YouTube video and another program and a new version. So the great thing about that is that there is always training that needs to happen for mm-hmm. all of those things. So, you guarantee yourself a job in that sense too.
Right. I mean, it's and the training is always, and I'm going to say technology, but it's always evolving. So you could build a training platform, a program for a company and come back 5 years later and redo the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Right. Right. That, and that's the other thing that we were talking about a little bit earlier in terms of trends when you're doing micro learning. If you're doing little snippets, then in theory, you also allow yourself to be able to revise things more agilely. Right. So you don't have to redo an entire course. You can do a piece easier.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Okay, well, I think we've each reached the end of our show today, and I wanted to ask Amy to let our listeners know how they can get a hold of you if they wanted to learn about your training and your diversity training and your PM101s for nonprofits, right?
Yeah, so
nonprofits.
I can say my email. It's rather long. It's amyhelenephaz@gmail.com. And my name is Amy.
Okay. How about you, Julie?
You could reach out to me on LinkedIn and you could just search for Julie Ann Scales or instructional designer and you should be able to find me.
On LinkedIn?
Yep.
Okay. Great. Great. And so thank you so much, Amy and Julie, for joining us today. It's been such a great show, and I've actually learned a bunch. And then just a reminder to our listeners that although this show is live, we do record them and release them as a podcast. So you can subscribe to the Learnist Show on Apple Tunes, Spotify, Google Play, wherever you listen to your podcasts, your platform of choice. And then, of course, thank you to our sponsor, The Learnist. Visit thelearnist.com for more information on our course creator membership and our Do It For You program. And that's thelurnist.com. And that's it for now. We'll be back next month. We'll be here every month on the second Tuesday of the month. And I will see you next month.